Good afternoon to all of you, and a very, very, very warm welcome on behalf of the Poetry Festival. And thanks again, as ever, to the Arts Council for their generous funding. Without the Arts Council's money, we would not have the festival as we know it. Sir Jonathan, you are very, very welcome here this afternoon. I do not remotely have the time to list all his achievements, his posts, his awards, his publications, to talk about Shakespeare and Coleridge and ecology and poetry and the ecology of poetry and all the other splendid things he's done. It's all there for you to read in the programme, should you so wish. But Ted Hughes, The Unauthorised Life, which we are going to hear about this afternoon, won the Biographers International Award for Excellence, quite right too, and jolly nearly won the Samuel Johnson. I've no doubt that we're in for an interesting and illuminating hour. I hope that it might just be a tiny bit juicy as well. And it's not entirely impossible that Sir Jonathan will let slip one of the six essential facts which were kept back because, in the interests of people's privacy, the facts that were withheld. What a fantastic scoop for the Deadly Festival.
Alas, no extra juicy facts. With regret, a couple of people are going to have to pass to another world before they can be revealed. It's a huge pleasure to be here at this fantastic poetry festival. It's my first time at the Ledbury Festival, but it's a legendary event, and so many great poets have come through here. So to have the shade of Ted, I hope, ghosting, crow-like over us as I try to bring back a few glimpses of his life and work, would seem fitting. The title of your wonderful-looking anthology of poems from the 20 years of the festival is, of course, the first word of Beowulf, which was so memorably translated by Seamus Heaney. And, of course, this last week also has marked the death of our great poet, Geoffrey Hill. And I've always felt, since I first really got into poetry in my late teens, that the three great poets of my lifetime were the three H's. Hughes, Heaney, who gave me a wonderful interview about his debt to Ted, his love of Ted, when I was early in researching the book, and Hill. So now they are all gone, but of course they are not gone, because that is the extraordinary thing about poetry, is they live on through their work. But how their work relates to their lives is an interesting and complicated question. And it's why biography of a poet, biography of any writer, but I think especially of a poet, is a genre full of elephant traps, pitfalls, a genre that needs to be approached with great caution. Especially, I think, for the three H's, poets who came of age as writers under the influence of the so-called new criticism of the mid-20th century, which itself was shaped by that greatest of all poet critics, T.S. Eliot, who wrote so much about ideas of impersonality in poetry. Eliot and his fellow modernists were in full flight away from the romantic tradition of the poet writing about his or her own self. William Wordsworth, you'll remember, at the centre of his career was a long autobiographical epic, which he never published. Wordsworth, looking at how in ancient times poets had written epically about the history of their nation. In Renaissance times, Milton had written his great epic, Paradise Lost, about the Christian story of the origins of everything, the fall of man. Wordsworth made that bold decision to write an epic about what he called the growth of the poet's own mind. Wordsworth, our great autobiographical poet, Romanticism, that movement in which the idea that poetry is the spontaneous overflow of powerful feeling, that it is bound to emotion recollected in tranquility, above all, the poet has the right to turn his or her own life into verse. The modernists reacted against that. So where does Ted Hughes stand in relation to that question, the question of how autobiographical his verse and indeed his prose work? He was a great prose writer as well as a great poet. How does he stand in relation to that question? That was really where I began the book. For me, the origin of writing this book was the publication by Christopher Reed, Ted Hughes's last editor, of Hughes's selected letters published a decade after his death. I remember going out and buying those and immersing myself in them and feeling, not since I, as a student, read the letters of John Keats, have I encountered a collection of letters by a poet that is so revelatory of the inner life of that poet and so valuable in helping us to understand the development of their work, their relationship to their poetic predecessors, their relationship to their age, and so much more. And I knew that those published letters were only the tip of an enormous iceberg. I knew that before Ted Hughes died, he sold an archive of his work to Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, in America, shipped out there in 80 tea chests. The published letters are just the tip of the iceberg. So I thought, yes, this is a project on which to embark. A few years earlier, I'd published a biography of the great 19th century agricultural labourer poet, John Clare. I've always been fascinated by the poetry of nature, the poetry of ecology. Equally, I've always been fascinated by some of those questions around whether there is some kind of terrible link between creativity and mental disturbance, mental illness. Many of the poets that I've most admired have at some time or another suffered from depression. Wordsworth did, Coleridge did, Byron did. And John Clare, of course, was a manic depressive who spent the last 23 years of his life in a lunatic asylum. And when I was a graduate student in America, I became a bit of a Sylvia Plath fanatic. Also, of course, I'm a Shakespearean. Much of my professional life has been devoted to Shakespeare. Ted Hughes was obsessed with Shakespeare. He read the complete works as a teenager. He went on rereading them and rereading them all his life. And his biggest book, the book to which he devoted more time than any of his other 100 or so works, was his book Shakespeare and the Goddess of Complete Being. A book that he said made him ill because he worked so hard at it and because it kept him locked in the world of prose as opposed to poetry for so long. I also have a long-standing interest in the theatre and in the influence of the great plays and poems of classical antiquity, as did Ted Hughes, a very, very interesting writer for first radio drama, then for the theatre, and also a translator of the classics. You'll recall how Ted Hughes's career did take a bit of a dip particularly in the 1980s when he became poet laureate, so difficult to write truly great poems when one has that public role as laureate. But then in the mid-1990s, suddenly his voice became new and he published Tales from Ovid, these extraordinary free translations of the great Roman poet of myth, Ovid. And then after that, he published Birthday Letters. So a career that began in stellar fashion with The Hawk in the Rain and Lupercal, his first two books in the late 1950s, early 1960s, that reached a kind of crescendo with the highly controversial Crow, thought by some to be the wasteland of the second half of the 20th century, the great work at the heart of Hughes's career, thought by others to be the beginning of a moment where he started indulging too heavily his obsessions with myth and folktale and his kind of fragmentations of language. And then, as I say, a period where his star seemed to be on the wane, but then in those last years, his reputation rose again and was assured. So it seemed to me, reading Christopher Reed's edition of the letters, that all my literary interest in the classics, in the theatre, in Shakespeare, in Romanticism, in the poetry of nature, in the relationship between the work of the creative artist and environmental campaigning. Hughes was a great campaigner against the pollution of rivers in the West Country. All those seemed to come together in Hughes, and it seemed an obvious topic for me to devote my next biography to. But of course, a good literary biography needs quotation. So I knew that if the project was to work as I originally conceived it, it would need the support of Ted Hughes's publisher, Faber and Faber, and of his widow, Carol Hughes, who holds the copyright to his estate. Rather to my surprise, Faber and Faber and Carol Hughes looked at my proposal and agreed to cooperate fully with the book, although making it clear that full cooperation was not synonymous with authorization. And I began to meet with Carol Hughes. Indeed, she was very helpful to me. She invited me down to Court Green, the home that Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath found back in 1960. She said to me, Ted did photocopy a lot of that archive before selling it to America. Would you like the photocopies? So she filled my car with photocopies, thus greatly reducing the amount of time I had to spend in America, although I did have an extraordinarily interesting period of research down at Emory. But it was made clear by Faber and the estate that this would be a literary life. And of course, that's what the life of a poet should be. So the ground rule was that everything in the life that I could demonstrate fed into the work, shaped the work, was within bounds. Things that did not impinge upon the work were out of bounds. And that seemed to me a very satisfactory arrangement. But then I discovered that there was a huge second archive. When Ted Hughes sold that first archive to America, he said, "I'm just holding back a few things that I'm still working on." And I think probably the librarian, Steve Ennis, who bought it, sort of imagined, you know, this was just a couple of box files, as it were. But of course, what he was working on was Birthday Letters, a project I subsequently discovered that he'd been working on for nearly 30 years. So what he held back from that first archive were hundreds and hundreds of poems, different drafts of poems, of what eventually became Birthday Letters, and indeed many, many Birthday Letters-related poems that are still unpublished. And indeed, he also held back an enormous number of personal autobiographical reflections, effectively journal and diary entries. It wasn't a journal like Sylvia Plath's organised, neatly bound journals. He had enormous numbers of notebooks. And it was funny, I'd noticed when I worked in the archive in Atlanta that sometimes there'd be a few pages ripped from a notebook, gaps. I assumed these would just have been drafts of poems he wasn't happy with that he'd thrown away. A bad assumption that he kept everything. There's one particular poem called The Gulkana in his collection, River. I found 150 pages of drafts for a two-page poem. Then I went to the British Library, where the second archive had been lodged. It was quite a long time before it was finally catalogued. But once I started working through it, I found it was almost as big as the first archive. And it was full of fascinatingly autobiographical material. Those ripped out pages were the autobiographical material, the journal entries, the diary entries. In each notebook and each loose leaf folder, Hughes tended to mix up drafts of poems, ideas for stories, fragments of book reviews, and these reflections that often do amount to a comprehensive diary of various phases of his life. But he pulled that autobiographical material out. So I'd be turning over these loose pages in the British Library Archive and thinking, hang on, this paper, this ink looks familiar. Ah, these are the missing pages from the Emory Archive. And there was a huge kind of job trying to reconstruct the chronology of a lot of that material. Often there'd be a diary entry with just a date, you know, 7th of July, but you'd have no idea what year it was. So it was a huge work of reconstruction. In a way, that was my, looked at one way, my downfall, looked at the other way, my liberation, because I fell behind on the project, and Faber had been asking me for draft chapters to make sure the book was going in the right direction. I just hadn't written them. I also got this new day job as head of an Oxford college, which was a slightly sort of time-consuming thing. So a point came at which I asked for a year's extension, and the estate said no. They couldn't wait. They'd not seen draft material. They were going to withdraw cooperation. And of course, that meant that the book could not, in good faith, be published by Faber and Faber, who were always Ted Hughes' publisher. Indeed, one of my regrets about the change of course the book took, I don't have many regrets, but one of them is that I was allowed exclusive access to Hughes's correspondence in the Faber and Faber archive for the original project. But once the book slightly changed and it went to another publisher, I wasn't allowed to quote from that at all. And that means one of my regrets about the book is it doesn't really do full justice to Ted Hughes's relationship with his editors at Faber and Faber, particularly Charles Monteith, who was his first editor and a very interesting figure. This fantastic Monteith-Hughes correspondence, and indeed correspondence and annotations by T.S. Eliot, because of course he was in charge of Faber and Faber at the time. That was a shame that I wasn't able to quote any of that. But it was fully understandable that Faber, as Hughes's publisher, could not publish a book from which his estate had withdrawn their cooperation. So the book had to be moved to a different publisher, and HarperCollins, under their William Collins imprint, took it on and served me with immense support and immense generosity. The disadvantage of it becoming an unauthorised life was that the quotation had to be limited to insubstantial amounts of work, or to a provision in copyright law which is called fair dealing, or in America it's called fair use, where one's allowed to quote parts of an in copyright work for illustrative purposes, quotations, but not complete works. And that was something I wrestled with greatly. You know, I've always say to my students when we're studying poetry, you know, you must support your point with a good chunky quotation. There is less quotation of Hughes's poetry in the book than I would have wanted for that reason. But in another way, it was a great liberation, because let's be honest about this. When you read a biography or even a history book or a literary critical book, if any of you read those rather strange forms of writing, I don't know about you, but for me, I do find if I come across a big block of quotation or indeed a sort of a full-length poem, I do slightly sort of skip over it, or, you know, the eyes glaze over. There's something about the shift of gear with long quotations that does break up the narrative flow and the argumentative flow. So it actually seemed to me to write a book about a great poet, a great writer, without enormous blocks of quotation, without the quotation of more than a few lines from a range of the poems, was a very interesting challenge. And in a way, what I sought to do was to sort of internalise Ted Hughes's voice, to use paraphrase. And as I say again, as a teacher, you know, I would always say to my students that it was kind of heresy to paraphrase the writer that you're working on. But I think that the mix of fragmentary quotation, paraphrase, allusion, and this kind of internalization of the voice actually did enable me to write the book with a kind of pace, a kind of energy that I hope was sort of worthy of Hughes himself, who was someone who wrote at enormous speed and with a kind of manic intensity. It's obviously for my readers to judge whether I've succeeded in that. But as I say, in the end, it sort of freed my own voice to have a kind of what I thought of as a kind of dialogue with Hughes's voice. The other advantage, of course, not having to work very, very closely with the an editor and a literary executor who would have their own interpretation of a life and a body of work, is that I had a lot of freedom to shape the material the way I wanted. And that to me, as a biographer, is always a challenge. How does one avoid the sort of deadening march from cradle to grave, the kind of just one thing after another, you know, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. Sometimes I think the problem with biographies that do that is that some of the key themes in a creative life get lost because references to them are sort of fragmentary and dispersed through the narrative. So at various points in the book, I held together Hughes's writings about and dealings with certain particular themes and had sort of thematic chapters that slightly broke the chronological pattern. So, for example, his obsession with Shakespeare, his interest in the literature of antiquity in the great plays and poems of ancient Greece and Rome, his work as the posthumous curator and editor of his first wife's work, his work on the journals of Sylvia Plath, editing the collected poems of Sylvia Plath, writing critical essays about Sylvia Plath, his interest in environmental questions, his environmental campaigning. Each of these things could become a separate chapter. And equally his life as a farmer. You know, there was a period in the 1970s when he and Carol ran a farm down in Devon, and one of his books of that period, Moortown, is very much sort of based on that experience. And that I think was a very helpful sort of structural device for me, because what one then found was one could map his different books onto different aspects of his life. So the chapter about Ted as a fisherman, a campaigner against polluted waterways, that fitted very nicely with an analysis of the poems in his collection River. The chapter about Ted Hughes the farmer fitted with Moortown Diary and Moortown, the two kind of versions of his farming poems. The chapter about Shakespeare obviously went with the Shakespeare book and his anthology of Shakespeare's poems. The Sylvia Plath chapter, the posthumous Sylvia Plath chapter, with all his editions of her work. And that then helped one to begin to see something about his development. And it was really in structuring the book that way that I began to realise that there was a key moment of a change of voice and a change in a sort of theory of what poetry should be that occurred round about the mid-1970s in Hughes's work that I just sort of simply hadn't seen until I was about halfway through the process of researching the book. As I said earlier, he came of age as a poet under the influence of a sort of Eliotic and new critical idea of poetic impersonality. He writes a lot about the need for the poet not to write about his self, but to write about bigger, deeper, darker forces, mythic forces, the forces of nature. If one just thinks of the characteristic poems of the early Hughes, those great poems such as Hawk Roosting, The Hawk in the Rain, The Thought Fox, The Jaguar, Thrushes, so many poems where he's using the natural world as a way of exploring deep human, natural, and mythical sources. There's not really an obvious sense in which an autobiographical self is in those works, and he wouldn't have wanted there to be. Similarly, Crow, the work that he spent the latter part of the 1960s working on and never really completed to his own satisfaction, is a kind of modern myth. It's a creation story. It's sort of plugged into lots of different sort of folklore traditions, ranging from sort of classical antiquity to the Winnebago Indians. Very impersonal sort of poetry. But then if one looks at, for example, the book that I think is his most underrated collection called Remains of Elmet, that he began working on in the late 1970s, early 1980s. A collection of poems originally published alongside photographs by his great friend, the wonderful photographer Faye Godwin, photographs of the Calder Valley, his native valley. These are deeply autobiographical poems about his childhood, the place where he was brought up, and above all, his family. I think it's really only after his mother died and then as his father approached his death that he felt able to begin to do that Wordsworthian thing of writing about childhood, writing about the past, writing about a native place. And so I began to see that there was a shift in his voice, in his work, at some point in the 1970s, away from a mythic voice towards a more personal, elegiac, autobiographical voice, a voice of memory and perhaps of confession. Now, of course, all his best poems actually, in some sense, combine those two voices, the mythic and the personal. But there is a very striking difference between some of the highly sort of rhetorical mythic poems, such as in his collection Prometheus on His Crag, between those and the very personal voice of the Remains of Elmet poems. And for me, the real breakthrough in the process of developing this argument came when I discovered some of the manuscript drafts of the poems that he published at the end of his kind of strangest book, which is called Gaudete. Gaudete is a very, very long poem. He actually began to start work on it as a film script way back in the early 1960s. And it's about how a Yorkshire vicar called the Reverend Nicholas Lum. Quite important at that point to remember that Ted Hughes's house in Yorkshire was called Lum Bank, and that he was himself descended from a very, very famous English clergyman called Nicholas Farrar, and called his own child Nicholas. A little echo there. The Reverend Nicholas Lum is abducted by spirits and replaced by a spirit double who becomes the vicar and proceeds to engage in rather colourful Bacchic orgies with most of the members of the local Women's Institute. It is Ted Hughes in playful mode, but sometimes in startlingly violent and erotic mode. And yet, when the collection was published, there was a little series of epilogue poems, beautiful, little, short, simple, elegiac poems, partly influenced by the Vakanya tradition, which was a form of Tamil poetry from India. He'd picked up a translation of some of these Vakanyas. But I was just struck by this difference in voice between this big sort of quasi-mythic story and these little personal poems, most of which were about death. And then I found a letter in which he told a correspondent that three of the poems were indeed autobiographical. One was about the death of Sylvia Plath, one was about the death of his mother, and one was about the death of a woman called Susan Alliston. And I thought, who is this woman, Susan Alliston? And that started me on a journey back into the archive. And the discovery, which I think for me was one of the two or three sort of high points of the research journey, the discovery of a pink A4 piece of paper in which he gave a description of visiting Susan Alliston on her deathbed in University College Hospital in June 1969. Susan Alliston, I discovered, was a woman with whom Ted Hughes was having an affair in the last weeks of Sylvia Plath's life. Indeed, on the night that Sylvia Plath took her own life, he was with Susan Alliston. And by a kind of bizarre set of circumstances, he was actually in the house, 18 Rugby Street, where he had first spent the night with Sylvia, and indeed where he'd spent his wedding night with Sylvia. He was back there with this other woman, with Susan Alliston. She was a poet. She worked at Faber and Faber. She's rather a fine poet. He subsequently tried to get her poetry published. But she died of Hodgkin's disease in 1969. And it was clear, reading this diary entry, the language of the description of her waving goodbye from your banked hospital bed, wonderful little poem, was absolutely telling the story of that last time that he saw Susan before she died. And it made me see that 1969 was the absolute sort of turning point, the kind of nadir in Hughes's life. That February, Assia Wevel, the other woman with whom he was having an affair at the time of Sylvia's death, took her own life, imitating Sylvia in the manner of her death, but outdoing Sylvia in that she took with her Shura, her daughter, by Ted. Ted didn't want his parents to know about this. His mother was in hospital for a minor operation at the time. But by an unfortunate set of circumstances, Olwyn told his father, and his father told his mother, and 2 days later she died, even though she'd only got in for a minor knee operation. He was always convinced that the shock of the news of Assia's death killed his mother. 6 weeks after that, Susan died. And when he went to Susan's deathbed in University College Hospital, it was the first time he had been back in that hospital since he had gone to the morgue there to identify Sylvia Plath's body in February 1963. One of those other three poems in the Gaudet epilogue, he told his correspondence was about his mother's death, but it has a line about backing out of a hospital ward into a morgue. Well, his mother didn't die in hospital ward, and certainly not a hospital that had a morgue. She died up in Yorkshire, in a nursing home in Hebden Bridge. It's clear that actually what's happening in that poem is that the memory is fusing between his mother's death and Susan Alliston's death, because I discovered when I sort of retraced the route into University College Hospital that the way that he went into Susan's ward was through just past the door into the morgue, which he had gone through when he saw Sylvia's body for the last time. So there's a line in that poem, "I kissed your refrigerated temple," which is clearly a reference to his last kiss of Sylvia. So it was at that point I realised that a very deep, very autobiographical vein of writing is beginning to come out in Hughes's work in the mid-1970s. And of course, what then happens through the 1980s is every now and then, without people really noticing, he publishes individual poems about his life with Sylvia Plath. The first one, I think, was in the London Review of Books in about late 1979, and Seamus Heaney said to me, I remember reading that and saying to myself, ah, he's begun. But actually, he had begun before. He had been writing many of those poems right back in 1969, 1970. So the publication of Birthday Letters in 1998, many people thought, finally, after 35 years' silence, Ted Hughes is speaking his version of the story of his marriage to Sylvia Plath and her death. But no, it was that he was finally publishing and making public. As I say, some of those individual poems had been published in magazines. When he published a new selected poems in 1995, it included some new poems at the back, several of which would go into Birthday Letters. None of the reviewers noticed, quite extraordinary. I don't know if Neil remembers that coming out, but there were poems there that now you look at them and you see them in the context of Birthday Letters. Manifestly, these are poems about Sylvia Plath, but none of the reviewers noticed it. So by the time you get to Birthday Letters, although obviously there is a kind of carapace of mythic structure being put over the story, The voice is essentially a confessional, a personal, an autobiographical voice. A couple of other moments of discovery in the archive that sort of helped me with that story. It is the thrilling thing about doing archival research when you make these finds. The argument I was developing was that he only goes into that personal, confessional, autobiographical and elegiac poems of memory, only goes into that voice sort of after those three terrible deaths in 1969. But then, quite late in the process, I found a letter that he wrote to Olwyn a week before Sylvia's death. And he says in this letter, Olwyn, his sister, he says in this letter, I enclosed two little poems I've just tried. They're in a rather different style from what I've been doing before. And he said, one's a poem about birth and one's about death. Poem About Birth was an early version of the poem, one of his absolutely loveliest poems, Full Moon and Little Frida, written for his daughter Frida, who of course is coming to speak to you on Saturday about her wonderful new collection. And Frida has become a tremendously dear friend to me, and it's given me great, great help with this work. Lovely, lovely poem, which he did indeed publish in Wadwo, his third collection. But the other one is called Uncle A's Death. And it's an early version of a poem that he did not publish until the late 1980s, when it was called Sacrifice, published in his collection Wolf Watching. And it was about the suicide of his Uncle Albert, Ted's father, and several of his uncles, especially notably his Uncle Walt, to whom he was very close, fought in the First World War, and his father, his Uncle Albert, they never really recovered from the war. And in 1948, Uncle Albert took his own life. This manuscript I found, written a week before Sylvia's death, is very, very close to what was eventually published as Sacrifice some 25 years later. Well, you see the argument. He was on the point of developing a more personal, confessional, elegiac voice early in 1963. But then Sylvia takes her own life, and what she leaves behind is Ariel, which he, of course, takes it upon himself to publish. And Ariel becomes the absolute central text for confessional poetry, poetry of the self. And yet it's received and understood in the context of Sylvia's own suicide. So in that sense, it became impossible for him to pursue that line of writing that he'd begun to develop in the poem about his Uncle Albert's suicide. And I think in many ways he wanted to sort of put the thought of family suicide back in the box. Here is an indiscretion now, because alas, it pertains to someone who is now dead, and that is Owen. Owen gave me huge help with the book, but we had quite a few fights. Anybody who's read about the process that the biographer Anne Stevenson went through writing the biography of Sylvia Plath will know that Owen was not always the easiest person to work with. Just a very decided sense of how to interpret her brother's and indeed her sister-in-law's life and works. She was very supportive, but sometimes she got angry with me. And one of the times she got angry was when, in an early chapter of the book, I talked about a story that Ted tells about how his family, just ancestors of his family, farmed up on this rock that hangs over Mytheroyd, the village where he was brought up. And there's a story of how one distant Hughes threw himself off the rock in suicide. And Owen says, "You made that up, Jonathan. You've completely made that up." And I said, "No, Owen, it's here in Ted's essay, The Rock. He talks about it as a family story that was passed down." And I showed it to her, and I said, "Oh, he's made it up then. You know, it's just not true." And I was thinking afterwards, why did she get so angry about that? Well, what she was angry about was the thought of suicide within the Hughes family. And in that sense, she's forgetting about Uncle Albert. This, it has to be said, was not long after the extraordinary tragedy of Nicholas Hughes, his suicide, you know, Frida's brother who took his own life in Alaska in 2010. I think Owen, because she had made so much of the idea of mental illness, depression leading to suicide, as being something that came from Sylvia, found it impossible to cope with the thought that actually it was also there, you know, perhaps genetically, on the Hughes side of the family. His diaries are sometimes very funny, which is worth saying, because this is a dark story. There's an awful lot of tragedy in this story. A lot of people have said to me, when you finish the book, what were your feelings about Ted Hughes? Did you, as it were, like the character of Hughes more or less when you finished as opposed to when you began? And I said, I'm not sure that like or dislike is quite, you know, what the biographer's position should be. And I certainly don't think it's my job to pass moral judgments. I think it's the biographer's job to try to explore every possible dimension of a life, but to leave it to the reader to make the moral judgments. But I did feel, when I entered the book, an extraordinary respect for the amazing resilience, the endurance of Ted Hughes, for him to have got through so many, many personal tragedies. So many people who he loved, who were close to him, died, whether by suicide or by cancer, before their time. To me, it's quite extraordinary that he didn't himself become either an alcoholic or a deep depressive. Interestingly, towards the end of the research process, I did discover that near the end of his life, he was taking antidepressants. And it's also the case, I think, that there were a number of moments in his life in which his way of kind of dealing with the darkness, and perhaps dealing with a kind of depressive demon within himself, was through a kind of what one might describe as a kind of a binging on desire, shall we say. We won't go further down that road, but I think there is that is an aspect of his life, an aspect of his demons, which it seemed to me I had a duty to write about. This is a man who was given by his schoolmaster when he left school and went up to Cambridge, Robert Graves' book, The White Goddess, and who was sort of obsessed with this idea of the pursuit of some kind of mythical femme fatale, as it were. And it seemed to me I was duty-bound when the telephone rang and a woman called Jill Barber said, oh, I've seen that you're writing a book about Ted Hughes. I was his white goddess in the 1970s. He took me to a party and introduced me to Robert Graves in exactly those terms. I thought, I need to listen to what she has to say, although not necessarily to believe every word of it. But anyway, I was talking about these manuscript discoveries, the Susan Alliston journal entry, the poem about Uncle Albert's suicide, and two of the others, which really just made the events of February 1963 make sense for me in a way that I don't think previous biographers had been able to make sense of them. One was the diary entries that Ted wrote himself in the last week of Sylvia's life, and the other was Susan Alliston's diary for that last weekend when Sylvia phoned Ted, and she gives an account of where they were and when at the moment of Sylvia's death. I mean, extraordinary things to have the privilege to be one of the very first people to see, and certainly the first person to write publicly about. But the other tremendously exciting thing about the archive, and I'm thinking here particularly of the second archive, the one in the British Library, was the range of unpublished poems that it contains. I don't usually complain about my critics and reviewers. The book has had by far the best reviews I've ever had in my life. The book has had by far the worst reviews I've ever had in my life. It's been quite a roller coaster. But what none of the reviewers seem to have noticed is the amount of really significant autobiographical unpublished poetry that I was able to unearth. A version of Birthday Letters, but with much material not included in it, written as a long blank verse epic called Black Coat. The equivalent of Wordsworth's Prelude, I would argue. I discovered that. An extraordinary series of poems written in the mid-1980s when Ted Hughes found himself standing in a Boston courtroom as a defendant in a $6 million lawsuit suing for defamation a Hollywood film that he had nothing to do with. Well, he did have something to do with it, because it was the Hollywood film of Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar, and he had sold the rights of The Bell Jar to Hollywood. It was turned into a film, and an explicitly lesbian relationship was introduced by the 1970s Hollywood screenwriter, in which Esther Greenwood, the character based on Sylvia Plath, and Joan Gilling, a woman she meets at the McLean Mental Hospital, in the film, they have this sort of lesbian kiss, and then the Joan Gilling woman commits suicide. This is not, it's not like that in the bell jar. There was a professor of psychiatry who was also a psychotherapist at Harvard called Jane Anderson, who had actually shared a number of boyfriends with Sylvia Plath back in the 1950s and had been in the McLean Mental Hospital with her after Sylvia's student suicide attempt. She saw the film and was convinced that Joan Gilling was a representation, a portrait of her. And so she sued. She said it was it would be detrimental to her career as a psychotherapist to be represented as a suicidal lesbian. So she sued for $6 million, not only the studio, the production company, the director, the screenwriter, the video distributor, the TV channels who had shown the film, but also Ted Hughes, because he'd sold the book to Hollywood. And this lawsuit, which lasted for about 3 or 4 years through the 1980s, eventually there was a settlement out of court. It cost Ted about £150,000, which in the 1980s was a lot of money. He said he had to sell the farm because of it. But whilst he was there in the courtroom, he read the bell jar for the first time. It's quite extraordinary that he hadn't read the bell jar till the 1980s. And then started writing poems about the writing of the bell jar. And he put together this long sequence, 46 poems, into a single long poem called Trial. It's never published. Indeed, it hadn't been opened to scholars until very recently, because all the papers related to the Jane Anderson trial were put under embargo because of the risk that the out-of-court settlement would have been breached if people had started sort of using the words Jane Anderson and suicidal lesbian and Sylvia Plath in the same breath. But Jane Anderson died and indeed left her papers to Smith College, where Sylvia's papers are. And I was there able to see a quite extraordinary deposition that Ted Hughes made in the court case, which nobody had seen before. And actually, in the course of that, he starts talking about the relationship between an artist's life and their work, the question of whether literary works ever are truly autobiographical. And I thought, that's a fantastic way of starting the book. It was also a good way of starting the book because I had this problem about limited quotation that I've talked about. But United States legal documents are all open access to the public. And I could, because it was a legal deposition, I could quote as much of it as I wanted. And that seemed important in order to get Ted's voice across to the reader at the beginning of the book. But I have a chapter where I sort of tell this story and talk a bit about these poems that Ted wrote about the trial. And I do hope that one day the estate might publish the collection, because although it's slightly unfinished, it's absolutely fascinating for biographical reasons, because he writes here about the last few weeks of Sylvia's life and how very frequently he'd go around. The idea that he deserted her is completely untrue. Most days he would take the children out to Regent's Park or to the zoo so that she could write, and many an evening they were together. And so I thought I'd just read you to finish a few pages from this sequence of the book, because my kind of beef with the reviewers is none of them's talked about this part of the book. I could make a similar point about an extraordinary unpublished sequence of poems called A in the same archive. A is for Assia, and it's some of those poems were worked up into a privately published collection called Capriccio, but others of them, again, were unpublished. And the extraordinary meditations on Assia's suicide, Assia's sense that as someone whose family fled from the Nazis, that at some level there was some kind of terrible resonance in the fact of her, Assia, a German Jew, ending her life in a gas oven. I mean, it's harrowing stuff. I won't read that for you, but I'm just going to end by reading about 5 minutes of my account of these poems written during the Jane Anderson trial. He remembers the evening of the day the bell jar was published. He and Sylvia drank sherry together. They tasted the sensation of her being a published novelist, albeit under the pseudonym Victoria Lucas. He admired the cover of the book, And now we have some lines of his verse. The dim, distorted image of a girl dissolving in a bell jar. Did I wonder? Now dare I read it? Ought I to read it now? In fact, he didn't read it at the time. This was at 23 Fitzroy Road, and he summons up every detail of those evenings. The electric bars glared in the wall, the matting smell of tobacco, the glass-topped table, brightness, freshness, novelty. He was reminded of the way in which she had furnished her room at Whitstead in Cambridge. The following week he went back and she showed him the reviews, the Times, the New Statesman, the Sunday Telegraph and the Observer. No pannings, no raves, he writes. So he summons up in this poem those few evenings, all that were left, the evenings of that fortnight between the bell jar coming out for the public and your death. And he summons Sylvia's face, coaxing his memory to yield him some inkling, some little epiphany that would reveal that she knew what she had done by writing the novel and that what was done could never be undone. On those winter nights in Fitzroy Road, they talked about the children as they sipped their sherry. What Ted didn't realise as they sat discussing the bell jar was that in her head, Sylvia was rewriting the suicide attempt described there. She was thinking of doing it again, of composing a successful sequel. The novel was the map of her journey to the underworld. It was a draft of her Dantesque Commedia, her preview of Hamlet's undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveller returns, no traveller except Lady Lazarus, that is. What I'm doing there is paraphrasing the content of some of the poems. But then a quote. The reconnaissance, the summary report of your exploration of that country where your nightmare reigned, the dead land ruled by your buried alter ego. Later in the sequence, he turns to the posthumous life of Sylvia Plath's works, how through the late 60s your poems crept through America and took hold like an organized addiction, your image in manipulated neons resembling flames was the martyr to their centuries of oppression. Yourself, would you believe it, their megaphone marching saint? Who is she? Who was she? The idea of Sylvia becoming the kind of feminist icon posthumously. Because of her suicide and because of the explosive content of Ariel, Ariel's electrocardiograph, he brilliantly calls it, in allusion to Sylvia's ECT treatment, the bell jar was read retrospectively as an anti-daddy tirade. By the time the novel was published in America, it was too late for the alternative possibility that it was less an autobiographical scream than, and again I'm quoting now, a sort of metaphor for the tirade many an injured wife would let fly at the daddy of her children, if only she could find the language. Sylvia, Ted argues, became a feminist icon because nobody before her, no woman before her, had emptied her whole soul of its rage against all that had suppressed and denied her, against all that had shut her from the life she wanted for herself, from her freedom. Now he understood about Jane Anderson and Joan Gilling and that the meeting in Cambridge. One of the key things I discovered in the Bell Jar trial papers was that Jane Anderson, this friend, came to see Sylvia in Cambridge shortly before she married Ted and told Sylvia in no uncertain terms that she should not marry Ted. Just as he and Sylvia had been finding each other, her suicide doppelganger, this is his reading of the bell jar, that the Joan Gilling character was a suicide doppelganger for Sylvia herself, had arrived on the doorstep to dog her new dream. She was the double of Sylvia's old disasters. Was she, and again, Ted's thinking of Daddy again, in some sense the architect of the beginning of the end of their relationship? But then he pulls back and rearticulates the position that he had held in the courtroom deposition. A novel is not an autobiography. A work of art is a work of art. It is not life. And one last quotation, three lines here. Esther Greenwood, that's Sylvia's projection in the bell jar, that is. Esther Greenwood is an experiment, an extrapolation from the mind warp nadir of suicidal breakdown. She is not real. The paradox, though, is that Trial, this long poem in which Ted Hughes writes these words, is about events and feelings that were real. It is a capsule biography of Sylvia Plath and a partial autobiography of Ted Hughes. Its story is real. Thank you. Take 5 minutes for questions. Absolutely.
Questions. The floor is yours. No questions?
Let's look at
that. Chris, is there any possibility that the diaries and the journal will be published?
I think there is a possibility. I started work on this book in 2010, and as I said in the talk, between 2010 and 2013, I was in quite close contact with Faber and Faber. My editor there was going to be Paul Keegan, who was the man who edited the collected poems of Ted Hughes. And he was talking about the possibility of a selected journals. Things have gone quiet since then. I don't know if the sort of fallout from my book makes it more or less likely that they will be published. But certainly, the things I would most like to see published would indeed be a substantial selection from the journals, and then these rather remarkable autobiographical poems, Trial and A, that I've just been talking about, because he's a brilliant, brilliant journal writer and diarist. He doesn't keep a journal all his life, but he particularly kept a journal when he was travelling. And there's a trip he does to Africa, fishing in Kenya and Tanzania with his son Nick. There's a trip to Mexico with Carol. And the trip to Australia when he went to the Adelaide Literary Festival in the mid-1970s, where he took his father out to see his brother Gerald, who had moved to Australia. They are the most brilliant, brilliant sort of travel journals. Such a vivid eye for places, people, customs, animals, the world around him. It would be wonderful to see a selection of them published.
Did you ever hear Ted read his work?
Yeah, I did. 1978, I was a Cambridge undergraduate, foggy February night, very, very typically freezing cold Cambridge. The Hobson Gallery, a little gallery in Cambridge, and there was an exhibition of Leonard Baskin crow prints, and Leonard Baskin was there, and Ted read from Crow and other poems to a packed audience. I took along a girl that I was trying to start a relationship with. I thought it'd really impress her. But of course, she was so mesmerised by Ted Hughes' kind of granite voice that I don't think I got a look in. Although, to be fair, when afterwards I went up and got him to sign my copy of Granny, he looked at me, he looked at the girl, she was very, very pretty, and he winked and he just said, "Good luck." And I won't tell you whether any of the Ted magic rubbed off or not. But anybody who heard him read would never forget it. I mean, you have this amazing experience here of hearing poets read, and let's be absolutely honest about this. Not all poets are the best readers of their own work. Sometimes a great actor like Tom Durham is a better person to hear reading than a poet himself, but Ted was the most extraordinary reader of his own work. And, there are videos and audio recordings in particular out there. I'd highly recommend the audio recordings that the British Library have put together of Ted reading his own work. It's the most mesmerising voice.
Thank you. Any possibility of the remarkable Capriccios coming out in the open?
Do you mean the collection for Assia? That is included in the collected poems. Or are you thinking of the Howls and Whispers? I mean, there were two privately published collections. well, Howls and Whispers is mostly Sylvia, or there's a couple of Assia poems in there. But yeah, Capriccios, which was Ted and Owen, and indeed Lennon Baskin, had this line going in these beautiful limited edition, very, you know, leather-bound, top-quality paper, very, very expensive price tags. And Capriccio, the Assia poems, were published in that limited edition form. But some of the individual copies had extra poems in them. So, certainly there would be room for a much augmented, supplemented, collected poems. The collected poems is oddly incomplete in some ways. Gaudete, the main poem is not in there, only the epilogue poems. A very bizarre decision.
Thank you for a wonderful evening. I wanted to ask you about the influence of Heaney on Hughes, because you said that Heaney was influenced by Hughes.
Yeah.
Forgive me if the accent gives away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Heaney obviously combined the mythic
with
superbly autobiographical poems.
Yeah. It's a great question. Yeah.
Somehow the combination of the time that you've described seems to me to be the time that he began working more closely with.
Yeah.
With Heaney, so I just wondered.
Yeah, it's a really, really smart question. You should find the answer to it in here. I mean, Heaney clearly becomes a poet at the feet of Hughes. I mean, you know, if you think of Digging, kind of Heaney's early signature poem, it's his version of The Thought Fox. You know, he's Death of a Naturalist, all those early works, very, very much shaped by Ted. But then there's a really, really interesting moment when Heaney publishes those fantastic autobiographical poems, Squarings, which then go into Seeing Things, or is it The Hall Lantern? I mean, it's around those two collections, Seeing Things and The Hall Lantern. Ted writes to him where he says, you've begun to achieve your Wordsworth's prelude. You've got that. It's also, I'm getting blurred. It's Station Island as well. Station Island is the key volume. That's the one that Ted writes to him and says, yes, you've kind of found this Wordsworthian voice. Precisely this mixing of the social, the mythological, and the personal. And it is very soon after that that he really starts writing more and more of the Sylvia poems. And then when he eventually completes Birthday Letters, publishes it when he's completed it, first person he sends it to for an opinion is Seamus. And he actually says there, you know, I've been influenced by you. You helped me on the road, particularly through what you did in Station Island. The other thing that I think is interesting in that regard is when Seamus gave me his interview for the book, which was not that long before he died, we were just talking about this, and there's a famous letter that Ted wrote to Seamus when Seamus got the Nobel. It's in the selected letters, the Christopher Reed selected, and it's about the sort of the inevitability of it being like a great wave, and so it's a beautiful, very generous tribute. But Seamus did say he always felt that from that point onwards there was a little bit of Ted that felt a little bit. The pupil has outdone the master, as it were. Of course, the fact is, Ted would never have got the Nobel because he's very, very English. He didn't, you know, manage to create that kind of cosmopolitan mid-Atlantic voice that Heaney cultivated so well. And of course, the Nobel is a curious prize, and because there's usually ulterior motives behind it. And Seamus himself would have been the first to acknowledge that him getting the Nobel was, you know, in some ways bound up with the peace process. Whereas, you know, if the Nobel Committee had seriously considered Ted, the thought of Sylvia Plath fanatics kind of picketing the ceremony probably would have been enough to put them off. And it's interesting, actually, Ted did have a very strong sense of, you know, that he was going to achieve poetic greatness from an early stage. And one of the things that his mother had a bad relationship with Assia, Ted did, you know, he did go a bit mad for the women in the late 1960s. I think retrospectively, sometimes you only sort of have a theory about a book a while after you've finished it, when you've got some distance from it. And I almost wonder now if his sort of womanizing in that period was almost a form of sort of post-traumatic stress disorder, that he was so just blindsided by Sylvia's death. And then Assia's, that he just sort of went completely off the rails, and that and sort of promiscuity was one of the ways in which it manifested itself. It's just a thought. But it was interesting that there's a letter where his mother gets very angry with him because Assia is a married woman. I mean, she'd been married three times before. And of course, she had had three suicide attempts before she met Ted. So there was a part of him that did want to perhaps to save slightly fragile people. I don't know. But his mother said at one point, really, Todd, you've got to stop this sort of thing. Otherwise, you'll never get a knighthood. You know? I've got noticed that, and I've behaved myself very well, and I have got a knighthood now. But,